You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today to talk about more C.S. Lewis stuff is Dr. David Grubbs, assistant professor of English at Houston Baptist University in Houston, Texas. David, how you doing?
Oh, pretty decent. The feral cats that once ruled our neighborhood seem to have moved on for reasons unknown, and now we have squirrels and blue jays and dancing mockingbirds, and it's like, I don't know, it's like Wild Kingdom up in here.
I'm trying to figure out if that's like a reference to the book we're talking about, or...
Seriously, as I was reading this book, I was like, huh, that feels kind of like where I live now, on a somewhat more rodent and songbird scale.
Well, also joining us today, and possibly also surrounded by animals, Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. Jordan, how you doing?
Good. We do not own any animals, and I do not foresee us owning any animals for a while, because I dislike chaos. But
you have kids,
sometimes
though.
Sometimes my children behave like animals. So,
I think it's okay. She's in the background. She'll give me the sign if it's not. But the wife and I have kind of different approaches. So she grew up with like dogs as pets, and all into the animals. And I grew up on a ranch, so I'm like animals are food or tools. Mm-hmm. And I can sort of justify a pet as like emergency rations, I suppose. But yeah.
I didn't grow up in that situation, Coyle, but I definitely have a working dog's bias.
Yeah.
You know, I like a dog that could do a job, even if it's not currently doing it. I like a dog that could do a job.
Yeah.
Well, even cats, they eat mice.
Right.
And related to the working animal thing, like the way I was raised, the interior of the house is people territory, and animals live outside. That's why we built walls to keep them out. And I do not get the let me just say, I guess if you've heard Michael rant about pet worship on the CHP, the flagship show, I'm definitely in his camp on that. I do not get that. I especially don't get, you know, allowing animals to take over your home. But maybe that's just because I'm not sufficiently ransom-like.
Yeah, I was going to say, your vision of paradise, the restored earth, is not a room full of animals and like fairies dancing on the lawn. And
on the lawn is fine.
Outside.
The lawn. Keep it in the lawn, fairies.
Listener, as you can maybe tell, we're finishing up our discussion of C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy with the book of the trilogy that is longer than the other two put together and not set in space, which I think we have ragged on in previous episodes, and maybe we'll do less of that having gone back and read or reread it. Jordan, do you want to tell us a little bit about the context? At least I'm assuming you put that on the outline, so...
Yes.
If my assumptions are right, can you tell us a little bit about the context here?
Yeah. So if you're not tracking with us, you can go back and listen to the first two episodes of this series, where we sort of look at the origins of the space trilogy and a kind of a challenge that C.S. Lewis and his friend J.R.R. Tolkien set for each other to write space travel and time travel stories. And Lewis being Lewis, he hammered one out, and Tolkien being Tolkien, he left it to Christopher to dig out of his file boxes later. But then flash forward several years. I think it was 5 years between Out of the Silent Planet and Paralandra, in a interestingly different context historically and in the career of C.S. Lewis. You get Perelandra, the sequel. Now we're just 2 years on from Perelandra, and I'm sure, again, we will talk about this a lot. It is that Hideous Strength is dramatically different in every conceivable way from the other two volumes of the trilogy. I was trying to think, you know, I had my silly analogy last episode where that Hideous Strength is to Perelandra as Return of the Jedi is to Empire Strikes Back. I think that still works, but it is so different. I was trying to think of a better comparison. And I mean, it's as if the original Star Wars trilogy was like Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and the Royal Tenenbaums or something. I mean, oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, David.
No, Star Wars, Da Vinci Code, Star Wars, National Treasure.
Except things happen in Da Vinci Code and National Treasure. It'd be like Star Wars movie where they just sit around talking about bears and planets and, yeah.
And sex a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we will talk about that. Yeah, my point though is that it is very, very like tonally and structurally different. It is written in a dramatically different style. Lewis was a very gifted mimic and parodist. So I think sometimes even unconsciously didn't realize that he was sort of borrowing from and even aping the qualities of other writers who had influenced him. And I talked in, you know, the Owl of the Silent Planet episode about maybe some sort of lingering Chesterton influence on that one, which I think is also present here in a different kind of way. And I want to come back to that. The big change, though, this is written in 1945 and published sometime toward the end of 1945. The date I kept coming across was December, but George Orwell reviews it for a newspaper in August, so I haven't been able to square that circle yet. Maybe he got an advance copy or something. I don't know.
Maybe he didn't read it and just wrote a review.
No, it's Orwell is more careful than that, and it is clearly. Based on a close reading, even where I disagree on it. So some of the stuff that carries over from the other two volumes of the series are some of these concerns that we've already talked about, like, you know, scientism and the sort of reductivism of the sciences, philosophical materialism, and kind of the effects of that on the human soul, and of course the fact that because those kinds of materialistic philosophies take essential parts out of you, start trying to fill them with other things, which is, you know, the trajectory you get with Weston and Perelandra, right, where he drifts from being a straight up Richard Dawkins style, you know, purely determinist materialist to some other kind of like Hegelian or Nietzschean thing. Some of those are present as well. There's also a lot of other recurring motifs from his other works that I'll leave for us to discuss when we talk about some of the themes of the book. The big difference and the reason it is so different, which is as close to a 100% established fact in Lewis's biography as you can get, is the influence of Charles Williams. So where the first two volumes are very inklingy, right, where he had you know, introduced them and read drafts of them to his friends, you know, his really close friends at Oxford and the Inklings group, which most famously includes Tolkien, but includes lots of other members as well, Neville Coghill and Hugo Dyson and others like that. The big change that has occurred between those and this one is the arrival of Charles Williams in Oxford. And Williams was a proofreader or an editor. He had some relatively important jobs with Oxford University Press and had mostly worked out of their London headquarters, but because of the Blitz had been relocated to Oxford proper. And because he and Lewis had exchanged a few letters a couple of times, interestingly, the very first letters they wrote to each other crossed each other in the mail because they were both praising each other for books they had coincidentally read by each other at the same time. They had already had an acquaintance that way, so when Williams arrived at Oxford, it was kind of quite natural for Lewis to, you know, approach him, and Williams became a fairly prominent member of the Inklings, but for a shorter period of time than some of the other members. And this is, depending on which biographer of Lewis you read, this is the kind of the beginning of you know, some sort of like wedge or estrangement between Lewis and Tolkien. Some will really, really push that hard. Others will kind of say that's been exaggerated. I'm not going to get involved in those fights. They remain friends and they correspond quite regularly, but Lewis's really close relationship with Williams alienates Tolkien at least somewhat, and you can see that in Tolkien's letters where I went through them again for this episode just to kind of see what he said about that hideous strength. He thinks Williams's influence ruined the trilogy. Thinks that that hideous strength is too much of a departure, it's too unsystematic, and that he thinks it's a fine novel on its own, and we can talk about that. That hideous strength is a fine novel on its own, but it is, you know, kind of corrupted by this Williams influence, and Tolkien always goes out of his way to say I am completely unsympathetic to his mind. Like, Williams just has a completely different kind of imagination, and I think that's evident. Some of the stuff that comes in here is Williams, all of his books have fantastical elements to them. Probably if he had written them later, they might have been called something like magical realism. But they're all set in our world. So rather than, you know, a portal fantasy like the Narnia books or a fantasy where you travel to a faraway place like the first two, this is set in our world, but it is invaded by the marvelous, which is Lewis's description of Williams's style of fiction, and I think you can definitely see that in the plot here. Williams was obsessed with kind of Arthuriana, of especially the kind of late medieval Malory variety, and some of the kind of prose cycles of Arthurian stories, the really, you know, hyper elaborately developed stuff from later in the Arthurian literature, and I have in the notes here. So fantasy set in our world, Arthurian obsessions, slightly weird sex stuff, which we will come back to, I'm sure. And Williams, and again, depends on which biographer you read, had some very curious relationships with female coworkers and colleagues. He was married, but again, depending on the biographer, either had a series of kind of affairs with like young secretaries, or just these like intensely dependent platonic relationships with women that he kind of regarded as muses off and on. He also had some interesting theological ideas, and I'm not a Williams scholar by any means, but he had these concepts of like co-inherence, which was this, I don't even know if I can adequately explain it, this kind of, you know, rather than, you know, different kinds of realities like the natural and the supernatural kind of like layered, they're sort of like continually co-inhering with each other, right? They're fused with each other in really deep and in intense ways. All of that you can really clearly see coming out in Lewis's the final volume of this trilogy. And if you want more of that, you can look up the summaries of some of Williams's novels, which tend to again feature like very strange kind of apocalyptic overtones, some kind of Arthurian connection. I think his very first novel is about the sudden reemergence of the Holy Grail in an English countryside town, something like that. And again, lots and lots of kind of supernatural elements in an otherwise realistically rendered normal, like day-to-day setting. Have either of y'all read any of Williams's fiction?
No, I don't think I've read any Charles Williams.
I read one Williams novel probably 20 years ago, because I heard he was in the Lewis Tolkien coterie, and there was one in my school library. I checked it out. I have almost no memories of it, except for thinking that it was kind of weird.
Yeah.
So that was my last experience with that. For those of you who are interested, dear listeners, I did a 5 years ago, I did a profiles interview with what was his name? Colin DeRees. On a book called The Oxford Inklings, Lewis Tolkien and Their Circle. That it focuses on the relationships, and so it gets some into the
not just the Tolkien Lewis Williams triangle, but also the controversy over what that triangle meant. In general, the book is meant it's meant to be kind of aiding an appreciation of what each of the Inklings brought to the larger group. But it also does not shy away from depicting Lewis as someone who is kind of poised between these two friends who he deeply admired, but those two friends had almost no understanding or harmony between each other.
Yeah, that's a really good explanation of the relationship between them. I haven't read that book. I've been meaning to ever since I heard that interview. I have one of his other books, and I can't remember the title of it right now because I've slept since then. If you want to really deep dive in all of this, Philip and Carol Zaleski had a book called The Inklings that came out 4 or 5 years ago, probably, which is. I read it because I wanted more information about kind of the lesser known members, like, again, Hugo Dyson, who fascinates me, even though you can't find anything about him. It ended up mostly being a biography of, like, Lewis, Tolkien, Williams, and Owen Barfield. And it's very, very good, but it does give you a deeper sense of, you know, both the actual association of these writers, as well as kind of a literary biography that works you through some of their major works. And so most of my understanding of Williams's fiction is tempered somewhat by that and by his inevitable appearance in other, like, Lewis bios I've read. So, very, 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 very strange stuff. And again, the Arthurian stuff we're going to return to, I'm sure. But Williams dies pretty suddenly and not terribly old, right at the end of World War II. So spring of 1945, the war ends and Williams dies, which is a shock. Lewis, I'm not precisely sure when he finished That Hideous Strength, but it's before the end of World War II and is published in, you know, maybe sometime between August and December of that year. And something I would like us to return to is that between the completion of the novel and its publication, the war ends with the debut of the atomic bomb, which Lewis has lots and lots of thoughts about later. But I think that is one of the things that makes this book kind of historically interesting, is that Lewis's vision of this world is pre-atomic. This is a pre-atomic dystopia, and I'd be interested to hear. For us to talk later about what you think a post-atomic That Hideous Strength might look at.
Maybe we should get back to that. I'm gonna say, spoiler alert, I don't know that the ending would have looked any different.
True.
Because Edgestowe gets nuked. So
yeah. It got blowed up differently.
Yeah. So again, published toward the end of the year. I looked around for some kind of contemporary remarks on it. We can come back to this more later. Especially since Lewis pretty explicitly, let me see what this note actually is. He says at the beginning of the book that this is a tall story about devilry, though it has behind it a serious point, which I have tried to make in my Abolition of Man. So, I mean, this is almost explicitly a novel version of a series of lectures or essays that he has written elsewhere, and we can talk about the relationship between those two later. But The Abolition of Man comes out the year before this. This is the same year as The Great Divorce, to put it into the context of some of his other work. And then within a couple of years, he is working on Narnia. But at the time this comes out, he is most well known probably for Screwtape and for his BBC radio lectures, which George Orwell, explicitly mentions in his review of the book. But there is it gets a lot of praise. It is also criticized for what we would nowadays call being quote unquote anti-science, particularly by J.B.S. Haldane, who is a fairly famous scientist and scientific writer. I want to be very careful making this comparison, but maybe before he went crazy trying to tear down religion, something like a Richard Dawkins of that era, right? Somebody who is a absolute scientific materialist, but also works a lot to help kind of popularize understanding of science and writes widely on a lot of scientific topics, but also critiques, you know, things like novels in the popular field. And Haldane attacks That Hideous Strength and Lewis a number of times, both in his journalism and journal articles, as well as in some books that he wrote later. Lewis eventually wrote an unfinished reply that was never published. So that you can imagine that those are probably fairly hostile essays, and I've got a link to them we could probably include in the show notes. I think Haldane kind of misses the point of what Lewis is doing, and Lewis is not, as he says in The Abolition of Man, he knows he's going to be accused of being anti-science, but that's not what he's doing. He's more concerned with the baleful state of mind that a certain kind of absolute trust in science as the only solution to human problems will cultivate. A more measured review comes from Orwell, who both praises and criticizes it, and I definitely want to include a link to this because it is vintage Orwell. His review begins with, "On the whole, novels are better when there are no miracles in them," which probably gives you some of his perspective right away. He does go on. He does praise quite a lot of the novel, but I think I like Orwell's review because even though he objects to different things than me, I feel like he's conflicted in similar ways. Says one could recommend this book unreservedly if Mr. Lewis had succeeded in keeping it all on a single level. Unfortunately, the supernatural keeps breaking in, and it does so in rather confusing, undisciplined ways, which we can talk about. And he ends the review with, "However, by the standard of the novels appearing nowadays, this is a book worth reading," which I don't know if that's as meant to be as catty as it sounds. I think that's all I've really got for context. There are a number of people who actually like this is actually their favorite book by C.S. Lewis, which I like it quite a lot, but I don't know if I understand that perspective. David Coyle, what would y'all add to that?
I mean, I don't know why people would think this is the best Lewis book, other than there's no accounting for taste. I mean,
exactly.
Like people read terrible stuff and enjoy it. So
yes,
yeah, I don't know. Well, David, do you want to walk us through the plot? We didn't do assignments for this. I can if you do want to try to do that off the cuff.
Yeah. So there's a bifurcation in the plot. Lewis is doing something very different from what he did in the first two books. In the first two books, the viewpoint character is Ransom. We know we are inside of Ransom's thoughts, feelings, musings, poetical, you know, meditations, etc. Right. This novel has scads of viewpoint characters. We get the perspectives of dozens of people. We get it, you know, at different points in time. But
and animals.
Yes. Mr. You know, let's not leave out Mr. Boltitude, who might be my favorite thing in the novel. This is a lot of Mr. Boltitude love going on here. As soon as Mr. Boltitude was introduced, I immediately ran into the other room and said and told Katie that there was a bear. That's my mileage. But the main plot is divided between the two perspectives of a married couple, Mark and Jane, if I remember right. Like, I keep forgetting her name. I want it to be something else for some reason. Mark is a kind of minor academic in a minor college of a minor university. never.
Not that any of us would know anything about
that. Yeah, yeah. What a strange and alien experience that would be. He is constantly trepidatious about what his standing is within that group. And then as a result of a relationship that his college is developing with this outside research institute, he kind of gets the opportunity to become more a part of this inner circle that he's fascinated by. And he gets pulled into first the inner circle of his college, and then he gets pulled into this institute that's going to be working in parallel with the college. And then it all revolves around this research institution, which Lewis has probably the worst decision of the novel, named NICE, which the National Institute for Something Experiments, I can't remember.
Coordinated
Experiments. But it just means that the word NICE in all capital letters shows up on like half the pages of the novel. And that's probably that decision just strikes me as kind of twee. Anyway, ignoring that, NICE isn't, as I'm sure everyone is surprised to learn. In fact, they are the devil, quite literally, actually the devil. And it, under the guise of this sort of aggressively materialist, progressive, forward-thinking science lab / think tank, it is actually an attempt by the rogue Eldil of Earth to consolidate their rule over Earth and box out the outer Eldil and Maladil, even himself. What looks like a fairly common or garden dystopia turns out to be an actual satanic experiment satanic plot.
And is it telling that when the devil decides it's time to make his move, a scientific bureaucracy is the tool that he thinks is best?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating the way that it works. But there's also there's a lot of meditation on the role of the press in political sure. totalitarianism, the politics of the police state. Like, all of this stuff is kind of boiled up in here. So that's Mark's side of the story as he gets embedded deeper and deeper in NICE. Jane, on the other hand, has learned that she's something of a prophetess. She starts having these weird dreams that turn out to have correspondences to stuff that's happening. And she finds out about this weird household called St. Anne's, kind of a, 1940s hippie commune, except very, very English, and there's a bear. Led by a man with a not quite as twee, but also very on the nose name of Mr. Fisher King, who is wounded. I see you, Grail Myths. But this is kind of the opposite conspiracy. There's two conspiracies vying over dominance in England. The conspiracy of NICE, which is a satanic conspiracy, and then the conspiracy at St. Anne's, which is a kind of divine conspiracy. So the novel is basically the struggle between these two parallel conspiracies, these two parallel plot lines, both of which are engaged with the spiritual side. I know that Orwell regards it as intrusive, but the whole point of the novel is not that the miracles and the supernatural are intruding on the human mundanities, but rather that they were always behind them.
Right.
and the mask is just slipping. Merlin is involved in ways.
For reasons.
For reasons, in ways. Everything comes to a head. It involves also conversions to Christianity of a sort. It seems to be mostly completed for Jane. Begun in a good, solid way for Mark. This is definitely stuff we need to dig into. Neither one of them ever explicitly accepts Maladil as their Lord and Savior. But Jane gets pretty darn close. And then the novel ends with the failure of Nice, the triumph of St. Anne's, the ascension of Mr. Fisher King, who turns out to be Ransom, to the earthly paradise on the planet Venus, where Arthur is, of all things.
Yeah, it is also Avalon, it's revealed.
Yes, it's also Avalon. Mark and Jane, whose marriage was on the rocks at the beginning of the novel, appears to be looking like it's going there. You know, those kids are going to get back together and have another go of it. And it's probably going to be successful this time because now they've actually learned what love is, thanks to Charles Williams, or at least some ventriloquism of Charles Williams. So that was a somewhat idiosyncratic plot summary. Any ways you want to tidy it up?
There is a lot going on in this novel. I'm glad you mentioned the shifting perspective and different point of view characters, because, you know, having written fiction, I noticed that immediately, especially in distinction to the previous two books, which are much more streamlined and straightforward, like almost comically so, as we kind of joked about how it's just a series of conversations. This is much more, you know, got that kind of mid-20th century, more psychological realism going on, where you're getting the push and pull of different tensions in the characters, all of which I think is really well done. But it is much more interior and maybe here or there kind of navel-gazing.
Really?
Than the other two books. I kind of
Pure Landra is very navel-gazy.
Yeah.
I don't know. It feels different here because I think we get so many more people navel-gazing from so many different perspectives at different navels.
Yes, exactly. different kinds of
lens. It's still just a series of conversations, though.
Yeah.
Largely.
But I do like things like we have Mark and Jane talking and their conversation is mundanities. But then we get back into their minds and we realize the ways in which this dull conversation is just sort of the tip of this massive, complicated iceberg that neither one of them are brave or wise enough to actually broach.
Right.
That is one of the interesting things to me about this novel, is the way that it gets into those human relationships in a way that the others had not, because it's just sort of like Ransom on his own talking to Ottermen or that one green lady.
Yeah, I think that's maybe one of the best things to write. As weird as that Hideous Strength is, and as different it is from the other two, I think on this reading I realize that's one of the book's strengths, actually, is that after having gone to an old planet that is rightly ordered, even if blighted, as we talked about, and then gone to a new planet that is only just beginning its life and is subject to temptation, to go to this kind of middle place, right, to return to Thul Kondra. So we're going into the Silent Planet in this way. And, of course, you know, the world building is going to look completely different for a book like that. And it's going to look a lot more like, again, a more realistic mid-20th century novel. And I thought that was actually probably, again, we can talk about some of the better or worse influences of Williams on the particulars, but I thought that was probably the smart move for the third volume in a series like that. Yeah, Coyle, I'm sorry. I know you've got stuff to say.
Oh, no, no, no. This is interesting. I'm enjoying the comments. I will say that this is my second time reading through, and something I noticed this time that I hadn't noticed the first time, probably because I was reading it either in my late teens or early 20s and was more of an idiot then, I think, than I am now. But
likewise.
Listeners may or may not disagree with that, but this book is really well structured in terms of its plot. So we, like David said, we do follow Mark and Jane through the book, but it's always in parallel action. So from the moment they split off in their separate ways, we'll see Jane eating dinner with the company around the director, and then Mark eating dinner with the company around the deputy director is kind of the chief on the other side. And then we'll see leadership having a conversation about strategy, and then we'll see the deputy director having a conversation about strategy, or the director, Ransom, and his folks having a conversation about strategy. And then we'll see, Mark locked up in a room, and then Jane in a room by herself. And, I mean, the parallel structure of this is really, really well done. Mm-hmm. And the novel moves forward as much as any novel can, where you have to read sections by themselves. It does all kind of move forward together, and you can see that movement. So in terms of, I will give Lewis this. I think this is a much better planned and plotted novel.
Yes.
Than either Paralandra or Out of the Silent Planet. It's still lots and lots of conversations, and again, it's as long as both of those put together. And for some inexplicable reason, my copy has a picture of the moon on the cover. So,
okay.
Mine has that too.
Moon strength.
Well, it's where the actual combat is going, right? Or that's what they tell us in the novel.
Yeah. Because there's that one member of NICE who wants to, for hygienic reasons, eliminate all life on Earth. So the vision you get is either of this kind of autumnal, bucolic life of organic, thriving, versus the purity but sterility of the moon, the surface of the moon. I was wondering about that cover art all the way through too.
I got the 3-in-1 Kindle version, and my cover art is, well, you can't see it, leaders or dear listeners, but yeah, it's a bear. It's a bear about to eat a guy. And I was like, what on earth? So, but you know what? At least my cover art turned out to be more accurate.
Yeah. Although it should have been a bear about to eat just a head hooked up to a machine, right?
Right? Or a naked guy. A naked old guy.
Yeah.
There's probably too many characters to go through individually the way we have with other novels, but maybe we can sort of cluster them together. Lewis does a very Lewis thing in this, and I'm interested, and this is going to tie into what David was saying about conversion in the book. So hopefully we can hit kind of all of this at once. There are two very distinct sides, right? There's the side of NICE, which, by the way, if you guys care, NICE is actually is an acronym for a bureaucracy in England today. Started in 1999, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. Yeah, wow. It's pretty benign. Of course, of course they would want me to think that, but it basically sets guidelines for health services in England. It no longer stands for National Institute for Clinical Excellence, but it still uses the acronym. So. Oh. There is an actual NICE in the government of England.
Why would that would be like our government having a NIM?
Yeah,
or Big Brother.
Why would you do that?
Mini true.
It's already tainted. Like naming your energy bar Soylent Green.
Oh, wait. There is a Soylent. Every time I occasionally get ads from them online, and I cannot believe. Every time I get one, I'm speechless. Like, do you not know what that reference? That is the kind of project that NICE would approve of, though, right? Is the in all seriousness, yeah. The kind of scripting out and the use. Like when I was a little kid, I realized at some point, if all we need is calories and vitamins, if I just took the right amount of vitamins every day, would I have to eat? You know, and that's what, you know, that's what NICE is kind of dedicated to, is using science with a capital S to quote unquote solve the problems of, you know, organic, natural human life in the same way that, you know, Silicon Valley technocrats are trying to do things like solve eating.
Right. What can I eat from my 3D printer today? You know, that sort of thing.
Right.
So yeah, on the one hand, we have NICE, the people who believe basically everything that Lewis thinks is awful, and are working, they say, for the betterment of the human race, but really for its ultimately for its destruction. And then on the other hand, we have the director and his company, which in some ways I think is more interesting. Both sides are tugging at Mark and Jane, right? Both sides are trying to attract them, NICE maybe more aggressively and more intentionally. The director's side more sort of, you're on our side or you're not. We're you know, whatever, make your decision. But within the director's side, even there, there's a division that gets mentioned several times between, I mean, we can just say between Christians and non-Christians, right? Sort of Christians and virtuous pagans. You have the Dimbles and the Denistons, and Ransom are kind of all the Christians, and then Jane and McPhee and I guess eventually Mark are the people who have, I forget exactly how he says it, like they have not yet submitted to Maladil. They're still on the team. And then on the NICE side, I don't know that we see that same kind of distinction. There are the different circles of knowledge of what's actually going on, but people who are on that side are on that side, and whatever their differing reasons are, they're all on that side kind of without distinction.
Well, you've got the putative director, this Jules character, who's right. Kind of a mashup of, at least in my mind, he was a mashup of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells.
Right.
Right, this kind of popular science novelist with these kind of,
right.
You know, pie-in-the-sky ideas about what science will do in the future, and he's not actually really cutting-edge science, but it's what the public thinks of as science. Mm-hmm. He's definitely not in on the devil stuff. And then you've got that Philostrato guy, who genuinely right. thinks he's been able to make that severed head live.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the deputy director and Frost know that that is not why the head speaks. So,
well, and again, there are different levels of knowing what's going on. But in terms of, like, if one of them starts saying, here's what we're working for, everyone else is like, oh, yeah, we're on board with that. And maybe you're using different words, but we all really mean the same thing. And when you mean the sterilization of the planet and the wiping out of all life, what you really mean is, you know, the betterment of human life. I mean, there's that kind of, they do kind of go, when they're all in their various ways trying to bring Mark in, they each have their own version of it. But I think the impression we're supposed to take away is those are all different versions of the same thing,
yeah.
Right? Different sides of the same thing. What do you guys think about this division of humanity? And the at the end of the book, the names we get, you guys are going to have to help me with the pronunciation. You medievalists, Logres, and Britain, where Britain are the bad guys, and Logres is sort of the pure older. More can't call them English, of course, because that's too Saxony, right? the you know, team God. I don't have another way to put that. And this battle is always ongoing, and in the moment the battle is between NICE and the director and the company, but this is the battle that they've had over and over and over. What do we think about this kind of lineup of the sides and this historical way of putting the conflict?
Logres is associated with sort of the Britain of chivalric romance. It's not consistent through all the Arthurian romances, but this word draws from them as kind of an ancient name for, I think, a region of Britain. But it it comes to be used in a particular kind of way, and I think maybe the pre-Raphaelites have something to do with this. Anyways, it comes to mean something like the Britain of romance.
Right.
So think of it as the enchanted Britain. Right. It's, you know, it's Britain, but it's Britain with this inherent power of myth and magic, and a landscape that is in some sense alive with mystery and beauty, and even the dangers that are in it. You know, nobody dies in an Arthurian romance of plague. You know, you die from encountering, you know, a magical beast or a color-coded knight who's probably some kind of an allegory. Right? The dangers are real, but they are beyond mundane. You know, so that seemed to me to be the kind of distinction that he was drawing there. The difference is that Lewis is actually presenting Logris as this was a thing that was real, and at times is more or less dominant. There was an ancient time of magic.
Right.
Which, you know, Merlin's real. He's like, he's buried, not dead, but buried and sleeping, and he wakes up. You know, there was an ancient Atlantis, an ancient Numenor, which he, you know, rips off of Tolkien, even though it didn't spell it right. you know, there was this ancient time of magic that is lost to human memory, and is effaced from mundane human accounts of history. But it's real,
right? And I'm sympathetic with that. I wouldn't say, oh yeah, Lewis is definitely, I mean, yes, there was a time when wizards walked the earth, but I'm sympathetic to that in fiction. Where I'm a little more hesitant is his use of that as a way of talking about history.
Yeah.
Right. There are the people who are driven by what's true in myth and what's true in stories, and there are people who are driven by, you know, cold steel and hard science. It's not like the people on the side of myth never use science, and the people on the side of science never care about myth. But those are the solid dividing lines. And one of those sides is everything that's good and true and right, and the other of those sides is the attempt to exterminate mankind.
Yeah, it seems as if he really wants people like the Romantics, you know, the good old pagans, the sorts of people that Dante would put in limbo. He wants them on the good side. And the industrialists and the and you know, many of the scientists, but not McPhee. Now that's interesting. McPhee is at St. Anne's.
Right. He's the old school scientist. We meet another one who gets murdered, right? Hengst.
Yes.
I'm probably butchering his name too. But the idea is that they are kind of scientists of these, you call them the resident skeptic, was what he called him, right?
Yeah.
The guy who's so contrarian, he's never going to go along with any dystopian plan. So he teams up with the good guys instead.
Yeah, even if he's, even, you know, he tells Ransom, the director, that even if one day he does convert and become religious, he'll be a dissenter.
Yeah.
You know, so that's McPhee, but McPhee is still on the side of good, right? Even if his worldview is insufficient to elucidate and defend the moral right, his inner compass still points true north in that way.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I think maybe McPhee represents something like Dante's Limbo, something like the good of which human reason is capable.
Virgil.
Virgil.
Yeah. And I do wonder if some of that comes down to a problem that I run into in Lewis, not just in this book, but in basically everything that he writes, is the absence of the cross, right, in any discussion of things like conversion or apologetics or what have you. So even like you were saying earlier, when Jane has her religious experience in the garden, or Mark has his moment in the isolation room, which I forget exactly how they describe that, right? It's just the idea that there is a normal, I think is the language that's used, and he's on the side of the normal and opposed to this crooked line.
Yeah.
Even when there is a cross in the room with him, right? It's still done in the language of normal and crooked.
Yeah.
You start getting into, all right, where does atonement come into this? Where does repentance come into this? Where does faith come into this? That's where I think Lewis gets a little squishy, both in his novels and in his apologetics. But it also leaves him free to do things like include McPhee, on the side of the people who are fighting for good, or Jane up until that moment. Mm-hmm. I might be misreading that, but that's sort of how I would come away with that.
I don't think you're misreading it. I think that this is something in Lewis that he's not a Vantillian. Right.
No.
His apologetic approach is definitely one of a there's a certain degree that you can work in terms of kind of reason and innate human intuition, that unless there is a kind of a strong cultural bent to drum that out of the human soul, which you see some of that in Mark's kind of initiation rites, where they are, you know, in kind of petty and puerile and then ultimately blasphemous ways, trying to sort of systematically get him to violate the taboos, the courtesies, the moral qualms of what is kind of the what he calls what Lewis calls the Tao, right? That kind of universal human basic ethic, right? That unless there's been some massive suppression of that there's much within the human that that ought to be good, right? At least convicting of sin, even
sure,
when we don't
and
obey it.
I like to think that even a Vantillian would agree with that.
Yeah.
Right. It's the question of well then what? Right. What is on the positive side of that? And at least in this book, it seems to be kind of a vague theism combined with good action in the world, right? A submission to God in broad strokes, and a resolution to live according to the Tao or the normal or again whatever phrase we're using.
Yeah. It's unsatisfactory in that regard, yes.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Jordan?
I was just going to say, I think maybe I'm always hesitant to read fiction autobiographically because that can lead you into such fervid swamps trying to do that. But I think characters in Lewis's fiction who go through conversion experiences, Lewis is almost always drawing on his own conversion experience for that.
Yes, which
is probably considerably more rational than a lot of people's. And I think McPhee plays a role in that, because I think if you've read Surprised by Joy, I feel like he is very strongly based on, you know, the guy who tutored him one-on-one for several years. Was it Kirkpatrick? I was going to say...
Kilpatrick or Kirkpatrick.
I can never remember. Right. Yeah, but he was a... I mean, if you remember their very first encounter with, you know, a student-aged C.S. Lewis, you know, he said, you know, some kind of idle remark about the weather, and Kirkpatrick immediately started grilling him on, like, what makes you think you can say that the weather was good, as opposed to what, you know, what standard of goodness, blah, blah, blah. And what Lewis, you know, learned from Kirkpatrick was a wholly rational attitude that was, like, 100% open to the evidence without, you know, the kind of, again, where members of NICE would draw up because they've got these preconceived notions about, you know, that they are materialists because they want certain things to be true, where a Kirkpatrick or a McPhee is going to follow the evidence where it leads him, but he has such a high standard of evidence, maybe he never quite gets there, but he is at least, like you said, pointed toward the good. And with Mark, you know, it's his awakening and coming around to some of these rational currents that are swirling around him and him recognizing them for what they are that just puts him on like the first two or three steps of a journey like that. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, Mark, neither Mark nor Jane ever really gets to the point where they're going to be doing theology or really looking at the mechanics of, you know, repentance and atonement and you know, the conversion into a Christian community, but they're tracking toward it. And
right.
I don't know. I think that's maybe one. It has its issues, like y'all underlined really well, but in fiction, conversion scenes are like poison. I mean, they sure will just kill it dead. So I think that's probably I think it was smart, particularly for him to end with the, you know, the last two sections are the physical and spiritual reunion of Mark and Jane, which is clearly meant to, you know, through that Williams kind of co-inherence thing, be emblematic of what is happening to them on a higher spiritual plane at the same time. I don't know how. Yeah, right. I don't. That's my somewhat apologia for Lewis's presentation of those elements. And again, not that it's without problems, but I think that's what's going on there.
Yeah, I think they're both being presented as you say, Jordan. They're taking different journeys that don't take them all the way.
Yeah, yeah. And we are just seeing the crucial phases, the crucial moments.
You know, Ransom explicitly tells Jane, you are not yet of us because you don't trust Maladil. Right. Right. Which is, you know, sort of the interplanetary name for Christ. So that's there.
Well, listener, once again, we find ourselves having recorded something that is too long to drop as a single episode. So tune in next time to hear the rest of our discussion on That Hideous Strength. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please listen to other podcasts in our family and find more information about our own show and our show notes at christianhumanist.org. You can also find us on iTunes, on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or you can send us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.